OutofSight.net presents Steve Prine of the National Library Service, hosted by Rich DeStenno, at our 9th birthday celebration on January 28, 2017.
I have Steve Prine from National Library Service on the line. Steve, as you probably know, OutofSight.net is a chat slash game slash learning site, let's say, for the blind and visually handicapped. We have quite a few people right now in our virtual room. It's our 9th birthday. I'm going to turn it over to you and give us whatever overview you'd like to give. And at the end, I have some questions, and maybe we'll get some additional questions. So over to you, Steve.
Okay. Thank you very much. Well, good afternoon. My name is Steve Prine, and I'm the Assistant Chief of the Network Division at the National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. I have been with the National Library Service, or NLS as we refer to it. Before that, I actually worked with the Regional Library in South Carolina, and before that, the Regional Library in Florida. So I have a good many years of experience in working in this program. And first, I'd like to say happy birthday to the 9th birthday, or the 9th anniversary of this group. And we appreciate the opportunity to talk about NLS and provide some information and hopefully answer some questions. The library service for blind individuals really dates back to the 19th century with the establishment of a library program at Boston Public Library, providing books in embossed format in 1868. Toward the end of the century, other public libraries around in the country, Chicago, Detroit, Philadelphia, New York, and the Library of Congress actually initiated library programs for the blind. When the Jefferson Building, which is our main building now, was dedicated in 1897, it actually had a reading room for blind readers. And with each of the libraries provided books in embossed format, but at that time there was no single format used. There were at least 5 different systems that were used in different libraries. So even if a blind reader moved from New York to Boston, they couldn't, even if they could avail themselves of the service, they might not necessarily be able to read the system that the new library had. But it really wasn't until after World War I that 3 major organizations for the blind, the American Foundation for the Blind in New York, the American Printing House for the Blind in Louisville, Kentucky, and the Braille Institute in Los Angeles, along with a great number of blind readers, lobbied Congress for a national program. That lobbying effort paid off in 1931 with the passage of the Pratt-Smoot Act. Ruth Pratt was a representative from New York, and Reed Smoot was a senator from Utah. And the bill was signed into law by President Herbert Hoover on March 1, 1931. So in a little over a month and a half from now, we will be celebrating our 86th birthday. The law has been amended. The Pratt-Smoot Act has been amended. It was amended in 1934. The original law basically authorized the Library of Congress to provide books in embossed format for blind adults living in the United States. The law was amended in 1934 to include sound recordings. It was amended again in 1952 to include children, and they did that by actually just removing the word adult. So the wording was the Library of Congress was authorized to serve blind residents of the United States. The law was amended again in 1962 to implement a music section, which still exists at NLS today, and serves some 1,200 blind musicians nationwide. And when I say music, I'm really talking about musical scores in Braille or a large print, which is called bold note. It isn't listening music, but it is actual musical scores. The law was amended again in 1967 to include physically handicapped individuals. Anyone who cannot read a book or hold a book or turn its pages. The law was amended for the last time to date, actually last year, last July in 2016, when the law was amended again to remove the word sound from the sound reproducers. So we are now allowed to produce reproducers for all types of format. And I'll come back and talk about that more later. From the beginning, this has been a very unique program. The Library of Congress in that original law was also authorized to come to agreements with regional centers for the circulation of the materials. And in 1931, 19 libraries joined the network. In 1934, when sound reproducers were added, another 7 libraries joined the network. So from 1934 through 1950, the Library of Congress and 26 regional libraries served all eligible readers across the U.S. In 1950, there was a second growth of libraries in our network with the establishment of a regional library in Florida. And that second growth lasted through 1976 when regional libraries were established in Montpelier, Vermont and Anchorage, Alaska. That gave us, at that point, 56 libraries. Each of the 5 states, California, Michigan, New York, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, had 2 regional libraries each. There were also regional libraries in the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. In 1995, well, I should say that 2 states did not have regional libraries, North Dakota and Wyoming. Eligible readers in those states were served by South Dakota and Utah, respectively. In 1995, North Dakota established a regional library, which gave us 57. Unfortunately, between then and now, 2 regional libraries have closed, but they were in states with multiple libraries. In Michigan, Wayne County Library served only Wayne County, and the Library of Michigan in Lansing served the rest of the state. The Wayne County closed, so Michigan has, the library has assumed service for the whole state. The same thing happened in Ohio. The Cleveland Public Library administered a regional library serving northern Ohio, and the Public Library of Cincinnati and Hamilton County administered regional library for southern Ohio. That one closed a number of years ago in 2009, and Cleveland has assumed responsibility for the whole state. So we are really back to 55 regional libraries. Also at the time in the late 60s, early 70s, the first sub-regional libraries were implemented. The first one was in Anniston, Alabama, and that spread to other states through the South, the Midlands and the North, and somewhat in the West over the next 15, 20 years. In 1985, we had a high of 104 sub-regional libraries. But after that point, they began to drop off, and it happened for a number of reasons, mostly financial at the and staffing at the public libraries themselves, but also regional libraries were automating, and with the introduction of toll-free watch lines in the 80s, the regional libraries were better able to serve people even if a sub-regional was no longer there to do it. So today we have 55 regional libraries, 31 sub-regional libraries, and 14 what we are now calling advisory outreach centers. And these are actually former sub-regional libraries that no longer do circulation per se, but do outreach and find new readers, do reader advisory. But their library is actually tied to the regional library in a statewide circulation system that allows the regional library to do the circulation based on input from the AOC. I should point out that even from the beginning, this has been a cooperative network. As I said, the Library of Congress was authorized to come to agreements with regional centers to provide the service. And basically, it was a handshake agreement. The states agreed that if the Library of Congress, now NLS, would actually provide them the books in embossed formats and then sound recorded books, as well as playback equipment, that the state would provide the facility, staffing, day-to-day services to eligible readers within the service area, usually a state. And so that has worked now worked very well for almost 86 years. And so we're very proud of that model because it really is a cooperative effort between the national, federal, state, and local governments to actually provide this service or to ensure that this service is available to eligible readers throughout the country. I mentioned that we started with Braille, and that has certainly been an embossed format, but the Library of Congress started with Braille, and in 1933, there was basically a decision was made that the Louis Braille system would be the standard embossed system for use in most of the English-speaking countries in the world. So the Braille system became the standard. And as our libraries evolved, all of the original 19 libraries were Braille-ending libraries, as were some that joined once we had sound recordings. The 33 and a third record was actually developed and patented by the American Foundation for the Blind and used exclusively in this program through the 1930s and 1940s. It wasn't until the late 40s, early 50s that the LP became commercially viable. But NLS produced books in that format from the 30s and continued. We got a long life out of records. NLS expected to discontinue hard disk records in 1978, but they really weren't eliminated or discontinued until 1987. Even then, we still continued to do some books titles on flexible disk through 1994, and we did magazines on flexible disk through the year 2000. During that period, though, we did evolve the process for the records. The records were produced initially at 33 and a third. That was slowed down to 16 and two thirds, and then again to 8 and a third by the time we phased records out. So all the flexible disk material that we did was always on 8 and a third. In the early 70s, the late 60s, NLS began looking at another format, knowing that the vinyl record format would go away, and experimented with actually producing books on open reel tape. And that really didn't work as well as was expected at the time. It was the right medium, but the wrong format. Happily, at that time also, the Philips cassette was introduced. And so in the early 70s, NLS settled on the standard Philips C90 cassette. So at a commercial speed, a C90 cassette would play for 90 minutes, 45 minutes a side. When NLS started putting books on cassette, it moved to record them at half commercial speed, 15/16 inches per second, rather than 1 7/8. And that allowed 3 hours of recording as opposed to just an hour and a half. But NLS took another step and actually recorded 4-track rather than 2-track. And that gave us 6 hours for a cassette. So one of our cassettes would be equal of 4 standard C90 cassettes recorded at commercial speed. And That was done for multiple reasons. One was obviously cost, because it required fewer cassettes. That also meant that the libraries had to deal with fewer cassettes in terms of inspecting when they were returned through the mail. It meant that readers had to handle and deal with fewer cassettes in a book. But it also meant that it met two other criteria. One was that the U.S. postal regulation covering free matter, which enables our regional libraries to mail material to readers, to eligible readers, and for the readers to return it as free matter. One of the postal requirements was that the material be in a special format. So by recording it non-commercial speed, we were able to meet that criteria. A second, and just as important criteria, was that NLS has never actually had to pay copyright royalties for the books that we have acquired and produced in Braille or audio. And the authors and the publishers that have owned the copyrights have been willing to give that to us. But we've always been very careful to live up to not only the letter of the law, of the copyright law, but also the spirit of it. And by recording material at a non-commercial speed and providing the playback equipment on which it's used, which is provided to the libraries to provide to eligible readers, we felt that that was an extra step in terms of protection. So if somebody found one of our books or one of our cassettes on the street and put it into their Sony Walkman or their car cassette deck or any cassette deck, it would play, but they really couldn't listen to it. So we were taking that extra step to ensure that we were meeting the copyright requirements. Cassette started in 1972, and we stopped producing cassettes in 2010. So during that period of time, we produced 57,245 different titles on cassette. By the early to mid-90s, we knew that the analog cassette was going to go away, and NLS began looking at the next format for that. And we felt a digital format would be the way to go, but again, it was the right medium, but what was the format? Even in the early 90s, there were probably half a dozen formats. There was digital audio tape, digital compact cassette, CDs, mini CDs, DVDs were just coming into use, and flash memory. Flash memory in 1992 cost $25,000 a megabyte, which was a little high for us or for anybody. But the projection we got from Gartner told us that by 2007, 2008, the cost would come down to the point that it would actually be a viable format for us to use. So during the last part of the 90s and the first half of the 21st century, NLS worked very heavily to move to that, to a digital environment. Interestingly enough, Braille led the way. In the mid-80s, most of our Braille producers updated their production methods, and rather than using a stereotype machine to actually, and someone that was really a Braillist, to produce the metal sheets that were used for printing, they began to then produce the Braille on a computer, and it could be edited there and proofed. So once they were satisfied that everything was correct, they could then use that computer disk, which was a BRF file, to drive the stereotype machine to produce the plates. This gave us a byproduct of BRF files. And the producers began to call and say, what do we do with these things? You know, we don't need them. It was just a byproduct of the Braille. And so the head of our production control at that time said, send them to NLS. So by the late 90s, we had a filing cabinet full of these things. And at that point, we began to experiment. Judy Dixon, our consumer relations officer, suggested that these Braille titles be put up on a website for Braille readers to download. And that was the beginning of Web Braille. And that site went live in 1999. And so there were 5,000 or 6,000 people using Web Braille even before just at the turn of the century. In 2001, the month after 9/11, in October, there was an incident where someone or some organization sent some ricin to the Senate Majority Leader, and that created a problem in that all mail to the Library of Congress was stopped for probably 6 months. And a process was set up to irradiate the material that was coming to us. Up until that time, all of the books, both Braille and audio, that went to the network, a copy of it came to National Library Service to be reviewed by our quality assurance section before the producer was allowed to make multiple copies to send to the network libraries. With this ban on the mail, that created a problem. And so the answer to that was to set up a process by which the producers could send material to us electronically. And we set up a website so that they could do that. The byproduct of that, of course, was that we then began to have digital titles available for download. We required our contractors to begin recording material digitally in 2004. And so by 2006, we began to experiment with a website. We had 100 patrons participate in a pilot test to download to see if they liked it and to use it. And that began to sort of expand. It was accepted. We knew that after we begin to produce our digital players, there would be aftermarket players that would enable patrons that wanted a different kind of machine or a smaller machine than the NLS player to actually use it to download books and play on their player. It turned out that the aftermarket player, which was the Victor Reader Stream, actually became before the market because Humanware began offering that in 2007. So at that time, we had a number of patrons that were buying these players and saying, gee, I'd like to be able to use the website. And so the director at that time just expanded the pilot to include all any reader that actually had their own player. And so by the time we went live with BARD, which was the acronym is Braille and Audio Reading Download. When we went live with that in 2009, we actually had 5,000 patrons already using BARD. But once we begin to put our players into the field, the number continued to grow. We began the transition to digital format in 2009 with four libraries. And by the summer, we were into full production for the machines and books. And so we began that process of spreading it out to replace. We have moved ahead with that. And now, almost 7 years later, or 8 years later, we are probably 90-95% of our readers, our audio readers, are using digital books. There is still some use of cassette, but it continues to decline. Of the 21 million plus circulation last year, less than a million was for analog cassette. The rest was for digital book, audio books, and or Braille. And that sort of brings us up to where we are. Before I begin to talk about the future, I may say a couple of other things, and one of them is that I mentioned that the size of our network library, our network now, I would talk about our readership a little, and we serve approximately 500,000 individuals across the United States, all parts, and I mentioned Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands, but also Alaska, Hawaii, and Guam, where we have a subregion. So our material is available, and all material that's available in the program is available to any reader throughout the country, no matter where they reside. 60% of, or actually almost 70%, 69.3% of our readership are 60 years old or older. The vast majority of our readers come to the program later in life as they acquire, in some cases, age-related disabilities, macular degeneration, glaucoma, diabetes, and other things that diseases that restrict or curtail vision and or with diabetes, even the use of Braille with fingers because of the constant testing that goes on. So the collection per se of our collection per se is pretty much what you would find in a public library. During the analog years, we were able to produce approximately 2,000 titles a year in audio. Now we made anywhere between 1.8 to 2 million copies of those 2,000 titles to give to our network libraries to provide to readers. In 2013, we were able to extend that. In 2012, some NLS staff visited an audio book publishers conference in New York with the goal of actually acquiring audio narration. And one of the major audiobook publishers announced at that conference that they were going to give NLS their listings and their backlist. And three other publishers followed suit. So we now have four or five audio publishers that are providing material. And obviously we followed this up with a formal agreement document. But that has allowed us since 2013 to produce 3,000 titles a year, which is certainly 50% more than we were doing in the past. We would certainly like to increase this number in the next few years if we can, but it's a matter of staffing to be able to do it. Part of our problem is that our collection development section has six librarians, and we have a very formal process for looking at books and determining if they should be included in the collection. I mean, obviously we try to do the best sellers, but beyond that, they have to find two reviews for a book to ensure, two good reviews to ensure it into the collection. The problem that they have always had, and we have always had, is that each year somewhere around 100,000 plus books are published, 2,000. So in essence, no matter what they do, somebody's unhappy, you know, because there just isn't enough to do everything. So the increase of another 1,000 titles a year is actually good, and if we can increase that further, we're certainly looking forward to doing that. That is sort of where we are at the moment. The next steps of where we're going to go and where we want to be. At our national conference last year, we outlined for our network libraries some short-term, medium-term, and long-term goals for NLS, which obviously means for the network also. One of the short-term goals was the implementation of BARD Express, and I'll come back and talk about that in a minute. We had two medium-term goals that included hopefully the change in our legislation to allow us to produce Braille, refreshable Braille displays, which has happened, I mentioned before. And the second short, medium-term goal was experimenting with text-to-speech. And the long-term goal was to move to the next generation of digital talking book machines that would have wireless capability so that a reader could download a book to their player, directly to the player, or if that was not feasible, the library could actually push a book that the reader wants to read to the player. So, and what has happened is that BART Express is available now, but both because of the change in the law, we're really beginning to look at requirements for refreshable braille display. There's at least one company that's actually making a prototype, and we have not seen one yet, but we expect to see one in the next couple of months. But over the next year or so, we're certainly looking at acquiring or determining how we can acquire refreshable braille displays and provide them to readers. Hopefully it would be the same way that digital players, cassette machines were provided, as well as digital players. A reader would receive one and use it as long as they needed it. If it breaks, they return it and get a replacement. But it's that player or a separate one or a replacement would be available on indefinite loan for as long as the reader needed it. On the text-to-speech side, as part of the agreement with the audio publishers to get the narration of the books that they're giving us, we also have the opportunity to get the electronic text. And that would mean that we could actually provide some books using text-to-speech for download. Now, I want to say right up front that this is a good thing, but it's not necessarily our goal. Our primary goal is to continue to provide voice-recorded materials. But given what I said before about 100,000 titles being published and only 3,000 being available a year, it may well be that having some additional titles that we wouldn't be able to do available in a text-to-speech format may be useful to readers. Not every reader, but maybe some. And so we're just really at the beginning of this. We're going to do some sort of pilot testing over the next 6 months with four libraries around the country, just to see what readers think of text-to-speech and what voices they like, and is it a reasonable thing? Is one kind of material more adaptable or more usable in text-to-speech than another? So we expect to learn a whole lot of things. And there is the possibility that we would be able to provide a number of titles that way, but it certainly will not be the priority. The priority is going to be human recorded speech for narration of our books. The other, I mentioned the long term is wireless capability, and that's in the next 3 to 5 years, we hope to begin to produce the next generation of digital talking book machines. We're already working on development of the requirements for those players to see what they should do. You know, we know what the current player does. We know what patrons like about it. We know what they don't like. But we're trying to figure out where do we go next, and what should the next generation player look like? How should it function? What it should do and what it shouldn't do? And so that's going to be certainly an ongoing, lively discussion with us for the next 9 months to a year, as we begin to sort of fine tune the requirements and begin to develop the specifications. But these, there will be updates about this through, certainly at the national consumer conferences with Judy Dixon or the director, Karen Kenninger, as we're moving forward, as there will be about professional braille displays and the progress in that area. To go back to BART Express, one of the basic problems that we found with BART is that it was a fairly complicated process, more so than we wanted and more so than some readers wanted. So several years ago, our automation officer, working with a friend that's involved in the tech industry, began to develop what we're now calling BART Express. And basically, BART Express is a software option that a BART user can download to their computers. It's window-based. But once they've downloaded it, they can then use it on the on their computer and just handle materials from there. Once they open up BART Express, there are a series of buttons to be pushed, or not to be pushed, but to that can be checked off. There's book list, recently added books and magazines, browse by subject, browse magazines, preferences, wish list, most popular books, browse by series, search bar, and manage devices. And using this, a reader can then download material to select a book to be downloaded, or since books in a series, and we've identified over 5,000 series in our collection that can be checked off, and the reader can download all the books in the series or just selected ones that haven't been read. They just basically, there is a check off, there's a checkbox, and once it's been checked, BART Express would download those books to the bookshelf so that's where they are. The reader doesn't have to go looking everywhere in their directory to find the books. They come to one specific place, and they can be downloaded from there to a cartridge. And at this point, as of last week, we had something like 86,918 titles, books on BART in both audio and braille format, with another 4,000 magazines in audio and braille on BART. So all of our magazines, even though the audios are available through the magazines on cartridge program, and braille magazines are still available directly, but also available on BART for download also. And at that point, I think if anyone's still awake, I think I'll take questions.
Thanks, Steve, for that very thorough review, and that answered some of my questions. I have a couple of little points I wanted to go over. One thing I was wondering about, which I think you did answer, I'm just curious if there's any more detail on it. It is pretty apparent that the program has expanded to the commercial market, which is obviously a great way to increase the number of books without having to hire narrators, et cetera. Do you have any idea what percentage of the books that are produced now by NLS are from the commercial market?
Right now it's a third, because we're still doing the 2,000 titles we've done for years, but we've added another 1,000 that are audit commercial.
Now, are any of the narrators that are in the commercial books, are any of them or have they ever been, for example, employed by the contractors that NLS uses, or is this a completely separate group of narrators?
As far as I know, it's a completely separate group of narrators. Our narrators, we did have narrators in New York at one time when the American Foundation for the Blind recorded for us, but mostly our sites are Silver Spring, Maryland, here in Washington, D.C., the American Printing House for the Blind in Louisville, the National Audio Company in Springfield, Missouri, and I think it's still in Vail, Parton Book Publications in Inglewood, Colorado. So those were the only sites where we did recording. So people, but most of the commercial audiobooks, I think the narrators come from either, you know, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles.
Now, did I understand you correctly that all of the commercial recordings now that are used, they're completely free? I mean, there's no charge at all by these commercial entities?
To this point, they have elected to provide them to us at no cost. Wow. I can't say that will happen forever, but we're happy that it has happened that way, and so we certainly want to do everything we can to continue that relationship.
In theory, if eventually that percentage of the commercial sector increases, the costs of the NLS would steadily go down because you wouldn't be paying any narrators.
Well, that's true. But what that would do, though, it would allow us in turn to acquire to do more books.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, that's a very promising possibility then.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, as I recall, the copyright law was amended, it seems like now quite a few years ago. At one point, permission was required, and I remember the books used to say, with the kind permission of the publisher, you know, XYZ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think the law was amended so that no permission is needed anymore, right?
That's correct. In 1996, the Chafee Amendment to the copyright law was passed by Congress, which basically lets NLS or libraries in our network to record or braille material as long as it's published in the U.S. It was provided by a U.S. publisher, and it's a non-dramatic work, and it's done in a special format. So that really helped in the sense that one of the problems before 96 in terms of getting a book produced or getting it out the door was that sometimes it took a long time to get the copyright permission. We usually got it in the end, but it was not a high priority for the publisher. It was just, you know, this was just something that a junior staff member dealt with, and they did it as they had time. So the passage of the Chafee Amendment just allowed us to, once we selected a book, just to acquire it and to provide it to our producers so they could actually record or braille it.
The process before that amendment, when the permission was required, was that pretty much an automatic thing, or were there publishers that said no?
As far as I know, it was pretty much an automatic thing. It just was not a quick thing.
Yeah, right. That bureaucracy involved.
Yeah, yeah.
I think if I understood you correctly, you said that maybe 2%, that's 2,000 out of 100,000, of the books published are actually read or produced by NLS. Is that accurate?
Yeah, well, about 2,000 or out of 100,000, yeah.
Okay. So that leads me to the question. I'm very curious what the process is to select that, you know, that 2% from the 100,000. How does that work?
Well, as I say, we try to follow the public library model in the sense that we certainly look at the bestsellers, and we look at you know, what books are being promoted, what books are being talked about on television, what materials are being offered, and trying to match what a public library would actually have in its collection. We have certainly for the last 40 years taken the stance of there needs to be something in all areas. We may not have 20 books on a particular topic, but we would certainly want to have one or two. And so while we're following what's available, the bestsellers, and to be honest, we're a recreational or leisure reading program, so the top circulating books tend to be fiction, and they tend to be like westerns and mysteries and romances, because that's what people like to read. But given that, we certainly want to provide material on every other area that we can, so that there is an interest, or some interest, that something is there for readers. And some of our more interesting books have been things that you probably have never heard of. I'm not going to be able to remember the book number of it at this moment, but we did a very interesting book called The History of Salt, which is something that we all need to live.
Right.
And I think we did, and I'm not going to remember this book number either, but it was a history of the screwdriver, and it was called One Good Turn Deserves Another.
Very good.
So, the goal is really something for everybody, or something for every interest. And in fact, by adding the additional commercial audio, we're hoping that that's going to help with that, as well as the text-to-speech, because even though text-to-speech isn't a preferred method, it would be better than not having access to something at all if it could be made available.
Yeah, I think that does open, probably will open the door to a lot more books. The other thing in that process of selecting that relatively small percentage from the great body of work, are there any hard immutable rules that the selectors must follow? In other words, a book might be a bestseller, it might be hugely popular, but because of a certain rule they have to follow, they can't have it. Maybe it's the content, maybe it's the controversial content or whatever, anything like that?
No, we try not to do that. I mean, the only really, I guess the immutable rule is that it has to be, the book has to be able to be translated into an audio format.
Right.
So if it was a bestseller like Garfield, about Garfield the cat, which were really cartoons, the pictures are just the words, the pictures and the words go together.
Right.
You can't separate them out. So we would not do those But otherwise, and we have a proud tradition that any book that we select to do, we do it from cover to cover. Nothing is abridged. Nothing is left out.
That's very important, right?
Yes, we think so, yes.
Now, getting to the narrators, I'm sure you know from being in the, quote, business, unquote, so long, and I've been doing these books since 67, 68, the big platter, plastic records, vinyl.
Mm-hmm.
We come across narrators that become our favorites. My favorite type of thing is when a narrator makes the effort to do accents or do different voices for different people. I understand it's a lot more work to do that, and I don't even know how they can keep track of all those people. And it takes a certain amount of talent, of course, to do an accent, German or Spanish or whatever. But we tend to gravitate towards certain narrators as our favorites. Is there any process by which the narrators are evaluated for what they do? And is there a screening process where, you know, they're reviewed and the issue of whether they're going to be retained? Is anything like that, or is it just like, you know, well, they do an adequate job, so we'll just keep it going?
No, there is a process. Now, I mentioned before that we work with APH and NAC and Potomac, which is the one in Silver Springs, and they're responsible for interviewing and hiring narrators, but we provide them detailed specifications about what we're looking for in narrators. But the studios, when we assign a book, they actually determine which narrator would be best suited for that book. If it's a technical thing, or if it's, as you say, with different accents or whatnot. What I would tell you is that even though we've been doing this for, well, we started, it would be 80 years for audio. Even though we've been doing it for 80 years, it's the narration and the finished product is still much more on art than it is a science. There's science to it, but the narrators bring the art to it.
So
bring
you,
the book alive.
I guess you leave the decision of who, what narrator reads what book or what series, you leave that to the people, you know, sort of in the field who are doing the narration.
Yeah.
Let's see, you had a couple other points here. I know you're giving us a lot of time, and that's great, and we really appreciate that. I guess it's in that same vein. You know, a lot of these books, being the types of books that are out there in the public for everybody to read, some of them have really strong language. These warnings are at the beginning of the books. And I don't have any limitations on that sort of thing, but I know there are certain people who do. Do you know whether there are, like, certain readers who just will not read that type of thing, and they will only read, you know, the tamer type of book?
Well, and we certainly, and to be honest, that's the reason for that announcement. Strong language, some explicit descriptions of sex, those are there for that very purpose. And all of our network libraries now actually have automated circulation systems, which they use to track reader requests and to send books. And reader advisors will talk to a new reader. On the application itself, there is a checkoff to say, you know, I do not want books with this on it. And so it really goes both ways, because reader advisors will call and talk to the reader to say, what are you really interested in and how do you want this? And some people say, well, you know, we check that off. I don't want any of that kind of language. And so they can actually set that parameter or that restriction in the patron's reading record, so that if the system is selecting a book, or if the patron says, I want this book, and the system goes to select it, if it has that strong language or explicit description of sex, it won't send it.
Right.
Because now, then in that case, the reader advisor would probably go back to the reader and say, you know, you told us this, but you're asking for that.
Right.
Do you really want it? You know, and then they can certainly override it. But it happens almost as often that a reader advisor will call a new patron and say, well, I see that you don't want any strong language or explicit descriptions of sex. And the person will say, well, my daughter filled that out, or my minister filled this out for me, and whatever, you know.
Right.
Yes, I would like them.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
And we at NLS or our network libraries don't care what a reader reads. We just want to be able to provide given what we have, we want to provide any of it to them that meets their preferences and their reading taste.
Now, before, in anticipation of your appearance, as well as some of the other guests we're having today, I kind of solicited people to send questions to me that, you know, they might be interested in. So I'm just going to go through a couple here as we wrap up the hour. We have a question here from Mary Kay from Florida, one of our more active members, and she says that there are certain books with the titles have prefixes of DBC as opposed to just DB, and she's curious what the C is.
Hold on a second. T as in Tom?
C as in Charlie.
Oh, C as in Charlie. I'm sorry. Okay, good. When we started Bard back in 2006, we only put NLS-produced material, our books, on Bard. When Karen Kinninger became director in 2012, she looked at that and said, basically, a number of libraries are actually recording material of their own and putting it in our catalog. If they would like to put it on Bard, we'll set up a process. So a DBC is actually a network recorded book. And I can tell you that we have, let's see, over 3,073 network recorded or volunteer recorded books from network libraries in Bard,
mm-hmm.
and that number will only go up.
Okay. A question here from Brenda from Arkansas. She says that when she downloads with Bard Express, her speed seemed to be slower than downloading directly from Bard. Do you have any insight on that?
No, I'm afraid not.
Okay. And go ahead.
I was going to say, she can certainly ask NLS download at loc.gov.
Okay.
She can ask that question.
All right, great. The last thing I wanted to get to is something you kind of referred to before, the advent of these commercial players like the Victor Reader Stream, and there are, I guess there's a handful of other ones that can mm-hmm. be authorized to play these downloaded books. I myself have a BookSense. I bought this thing in 2009, and it's still great. I mean, I still use it to play the downloaded Bard books. These things are really fantastic because you can just put it in your pocket, take it anywhere you want. And is there any chance that NLS would produce something of that type, or is it going to be the tabletop all the time?
It is probably the tabletop. When we were still doing cassettes, and that the C1 machine weighs 7 pounds and is a tabletop. I used to tell people that the C1 is a Sony Walkman designed by the government. And
right.
The reason I'm saying that is because it goes back to what I was saying before about 70% of the people we're serving being 60 years old or older. It needed to be a fairly machine with large buttons, and it needed to work the same way. The C73 was the first cassette machine that NLS produced that we didn't go out and just buy off the shelf to use in a test environment. But it was the first machine that was built. From that one through the C1, which we stopped producing in 2007. During that period of time, we produced something like 1,400,000 cassette players. And from the first C1 to the from the first C73 to the last C1, it operated exactly the same way. And that was done on purpose because you buy any other kind of device, a cell phone now or any other kind of advice. If you bought one 3 years ago and you get a new one today, it works totally differently.
Yeah, it's a pain to figure it out.
It does the same thing. Exactly. And for most of our readers, because they're older, having to relearn, we knew those machines were going to break.
Yeah.
And they needed to be replaced. But expect a reader to try to relearn something every time they got a replacement machine. It was just not viable. And so the internal mechanics of the machine changed over the years, but the facing of it and where the buttons were and how they worked remained the same. And even with the current digital players, it pretty much mimics that cassette keyboard arrangement.
Yeah, I can see that idea because you know, even myself, even though I've used a lot of technical things over the years, every time I dread buying something new because, you know, you need somebody to read the manual and then you have to make notes and then things are printed on the item. You know, it is a pain.
Yeah. And our goal really has always been for people to have the opportunity to read, not to have to to learn something else to do it. And so probably the next generation will be sort of the same thing. But that doesn't mean that there won't be third-party versions of the next generation player that patrons can use.
Well, Steve, you've given us an hour of your time. We really appreciate it. You've been very thorough, and I feel very educated now about the program and some of these things that I was curious about. You've really given us a lot of insight and information. And thanks for taking an hour on your Saturday, and you know, hopefully we'll all continue to enjoy the service and benefit it so much, and for people like you who put your time and effort into it. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you very much.
Take care.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.